The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good day, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, A Tragically American Approach to the Child Care Crisis. The U.S. is returning to a tired old playbook. If at first you fail to make something a universal right, try making it an employee benefit. And this is written by Elliot Haspel. For a brief moment, it looked like America could get a real child care system, one that wasn't defined by lengthy wait lists, sky-high fees, and crossed fingers quality. When the House of Representatives passed the Build Back Better Act in 2021, it included $400 billion in funding, part of which would have paid for programs enough to boost providers' wages, in turn increasing the supply of available slots. The act also would have capped all but the wealthiest families' child care bills at 7% of their income. This overhaul would have put child care squarely in the same category as Social Security, Medicare, and other guaranteed supports. It would have, in other words, become a right. Since Joe Manchin and the 50 Republican senators killed the bill, however, many policymakers have started following a tired old playbook. If at first you fail to make something a universal right, try making it an employee benefit. The instinct to make for any policy port in a storm is understandable, and the American child care system is stuck in a years-long hurricane. At its core is a financial paradox. Child care providers have very high fixed costs due to the need for low child-to-adult ratios, so they can't pay their staff well enough without significantly increasing parent fees. Many child care workers make less than parking attendants. In other words, child care simultaneously is too expensive for parents and brings in too little revenue for programs to operate sustainably. In fact, the industry is still down more than 50,000 employees from pre-pandemic levels. Centers have shut down for want of staff, long wait lists have stretched into the point of absurdity, and the rising costs of care continues to exceed inflation. The system desperately needs a large infusion of permanent public money so that programs can compensate educators well, parent fees can be slashed, and supply can rise to meet demand. As Ann Lowry wrote last year, the math does not work. It never will. No other country makes it work without a major investment from government. In his public remarks and his proposed budget for the 2024 fiscal year, President Joe Biden is certainly insistent about the need for a permanent answer to child care funding. Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren and Patty Murray, along with their House counterparts, have each submitted a major child care bill in recent months. Yet, in the face of congressional gridlock, Democrats and Republicans alike are turning to employers as a salve. At the federal level, the Biden administration is nudging companies to offer employees child care assistance, embedding such encouragement in the Semiconductor CHIPS Act and the recent executive order on care. Red states such as Oklahoma and Missouri have proposed, along with other actions like tax credits and donors to child care programs, sweetening the incentive pot for employer child care benefits. States such as Michigan and Kentucky are piloting programs in which child care costs can be split among the employer, the employee, and the government. The problem is that these are quarter measures at best. Millions of gig workers who don't receive benefits will be left out by default. And employer-sponsored benefits are unreliable because people may switch or lose their jobs, and because employers can simply change their mind. According to a recent Care.com survey of 500 companies, nearly one-third said they might cut child care benefits if a recession takes hold. Even putting all of that aside, none of these programs can ever hope to help even the barest fraction of the millions of families who want and need care. For instance, 2 years after its inception, Michigan's well-intentioned Tri-State Initiative reaches a grand total of 277 families. On-site child care centers can quickly fill up and may not meet the needs or preferences of blue-collar workers who require care during non-traditional hours. Moreover, none of these initiatives significantly addresses providers' wages, and opening new programs when you can't even find staff for existing ones is a bridge to nowhere. A child care system that relies on the employer-employee relationship is fundamentally flawed. There is a reason we do not offer public schooling as part of a benefits package. That is not to say that employers should be ignored. Some parents benefit greatly from having child care located where they work. However, these programs do not have to be funded and run by the employer. In a publicly funded system, on-site centers can be one option among many. Similarly, employers can and should be asked to contribute to the child care their employees rely on, but through taxation instead of fringe benefits. Vermont is set to become the first state to substantially increase child care funding with a small payroll tax, at least 75% of which will be paid by employers. The resulting funds will allow the state to make many more families eligible for child care assistance and help providers raise their wages. We've been at this crossroads before with health care. During World War II, companies began offering health insurance as a perk. This was done to get around wage caps established in 1942 to prevent the economy from going haywire as companies competed for the suddenly shrunken labor force. Coming out of the war, President Harry Truman proposed a national health care insurance akin to what would become the UK's National Health Service. The plan failed under opposition, not just from business interests, but from several major labor unions that had become invested in the idea of employer-sponsored insurance, a decision whose effects the country still feels today. Child care itself serves up a cautionary tale. In the late 1960s and early 70s, a wide-ranging coalition of advocates for elected officials pushed for a universal, affordable, choice-based child care system. Their efforts culminated in the Comprehensive Child Development Act of 1971, which would have created a nationally funded, locally run network of child care sites. The legislation passed Congress on a bipartisan basis before President Richard Nixon vetoed it. Soon thereafter, the coalition splintered. The historian Anna Danziger Halperin has written that, following this narrowing of political possibilities and shifts of the policy landscape to the right, by the 1980s, advocates no longer pressured policymakers for universal approaches. Instead, they focused more on limited provisions like tax incentives for employers to provide child care. The logic behind leaning on employer-sponsored child care is easy. Something is better than nothing. Yet this is not always the case in life or in public policy. In the middle of a hurricane, handing out umbrellas is a waste of time and energy. As America learned with health care, if we get used to a service being tied to employment, that idea can become entrenched and very hard to change. Today's stopgap measures become tomorrow's status quo. Marching down such a path will make it even harder to gain momentum needed to build and fund a child care system that works for everyone. Part of the difficulty in gathering that momentum is the lack of popular child care proposals that captures the public's imagination. Murray's plan has the most support within the Democratic Party and formed the basis for the Build Back Better child care provisions. Although transformational, the bill uses a complicated income-based sliding fee scale and a bureaucratic activity test whereby parents must prove they are engaged in work or school, or have legitimate reason not to be. One would be hard-pressed to summarize either Murray's or Warren's plan in a sentence, much less a viral soundbite. The time and energy spent promoting employee child care benefits, then, would be better spent developing a simply communicated, comprehensive reform plan. To maximize its popularity, such a plan should help with the early years as well as after school and summer care, and follow the lead of some Nordic countries with stipends for stay-at-home parents. The simplest, strongest plan to capture the public's attention could be to mimic the public school system and propose universal and free child care. Ideally, any plan would be tied to a suite of pro-family policies that includes paid family leave and a monthly allowance for helping with general child-rearing costs. There is significant political upside to getting this right. The child care pain point is deep and broad, and fixing child care is an astonishingly popular policy idea that could be put forward and center in a campaign. The miserable state of American child care is not a given. In the past 30 years, Germany, Canada, Ireland, and other peer nations with market-based child care systems have undergone tremendous reforms. Canada aims to halve child care fees nationwide, and some families have already seen their bills reduced by thousands of dollars. Within the U.S., in addition to Vermont's recent victory, New Mexico is proposing to make child care free for most families while boosting educator wages. The common thread? Large amounts of permanent public money. In the end, the country must decide what child care is: a right that every family deserves and that is worth investing in, or a luxury to be purchased by those with the means and bestowed upon the lucky few at their employers' whims. Next, The Crop That's Sucking the Colorado River Dry, by Samuel Shaw, from the June issue, The Science Section. Last month, California, Arizona, and Nevada agreed to conserve 3 million acre-feet of Colorado River water, about a trillion gallons, through 2026 in order to protect their drinking supply. The agreement will likely cause big changes for one especially thirsty user, hay. So-called forage crops such as alfalfa and Bermuda grass, which are used to feed livestock, require large amounts of water to cultivate. For the next 3 years, the states agreed to pay cities, irrigation districts, and Native American tribes $1.2 billion to use less water, including paying many farmers not to farm. Agriculture accounts for almost 80% of the water consumed in the Colorado River Basin each year, and alfalfa is responsible for more than a third of that drain. Alfalfa, a nutrient-rich option for feeding dairy and beef cattle, produces a huge amount of protein per acre, but that bounty comes with high water use. Alfalfa has a long growing season, which is another plus for farmers, a deep root system, and a leafy, dense canopy that needs plenty of moisture to stay green. That's not the whole story. Water right laws incentivize ranchers to use as much river water as they're allotted, or else risk losing access to the unused portion in the future. And because the Colorado River has afforded a cheap water to many western districts, wasteful irrigation methods have not gone out of fashion. That includes a technique called flood irrigation, which is exactly what it sounds like, watering hundreds of alfalfa acres at a time by briefly flooding the field. It's a popular solution. The practice is simple to implement, might help recharge underground aquifers, and can create temporary havens for migrating birds. But it's also wildly inefficient. So are those central pivot sprinklers that water perfect circles of crops. The ones that look from an airplane window or a satellite like scattered green coins. Those steel arms sweeping across the fields are less wasteful than flood irrigation, but below the efficiency achieved by drip systems. Arizona and California alfalfa watered by these sprinklers can soak up several hundred gallons a minute for a 130-acre field. By contrast, a typical 8-minute shower at home uses about 16 gallons. All told, alfalfa swallows triple the water used by everyone in the region to shower, water lawns, and do laundry. California's Imperial Valley, a juggernaut of hay output, laps up more water than anywhere in the whole Colorado River Basin, accounting for nearly 80% of the state's allotment. Much of the roughly 2.5 million acre-feet of water that the All-American Canal brings into the valley goes to alfalfa fields. Located in the Sonoran Desert, it's one of the hottest places in California and one of the driest, too. All of that poses a problem for alfalfa, which gets stressed when soil moisture drops and temperatures climb. In order to keep the fields healthy in hot places such as the Imperial Valley, southern Arizona, and central Nevada, farms make up the difference in other ways, primarily by using irrigation. Alfalfa can require the equivalent of dozens of inches of precipitation in a single growing season. Because regions like the Imperial Valley receive a fraction of that, farmers turn to water sources such as the Colorado River to make up the rest. Farmers working in unforgiving desert climates have their own reasons for cultivating alfalfa. For one, with enough irrigation, it can handle the ferocious summers in the West better than many fruit and vegetable varieties. Alfalfa is also profitable. From 2012 to 2021 in California, it fetched more dollars a ton than any other hay variety. Alfalfa is important to agriculture in Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, and Utah, among the driest states in the country, all of which depend on the Colorado River. In fact, much of the Colorado River is exported as hay. Rising demand for dairy products and beef across the globe are driving up the demand. By one estimate, 40% of alfalfa grown in California in 2020 was exported. When states and the federal government come to the table to finalize plans for the river cuts, they'll have to balance those financial gains against the water requirements of the Southwest people, ecosystems, and other crops. Meanwhile, the federal government still needs to review last month's deal, and the states and other parties involved will have to hammer out the finer points over the next several months. From the Ideas section, The Happiest Way to Change Jobs by Arthur C. Brooks. If the job search firm Monster.com is right in its survey research, you are probably looking for a new job. According to its data at the end of the year, that's what an eye-popping 96% of American workers reported doing. And yet, you probably won't actually make that change. One Pew Research Center study found that only about 30% of workers changed jobs at least once in 2022, which was roughly on par with the level of turnover in 2021. What accounts for the 66-point difference between aspiration and action? Psych Central, a mental health website, notes that a common reason people stay in jobs they want to leave is fear of the unknown. Will the new job be worse than the old one? This is a powerful emotion, liable to dominate other ones because, evolutionarily, it was so important to our survival. Our ancestors passed on their genes because they did not say, "I don't know what kind of mushrooms those are, but I bet they're delicious." You may know what you'd like to, that you'd like to do something else for work, but your options look like mushrooms of unknown origin. Thus, the devil you know wins out, and you stay put. This can lead to a lot of frustration and dissatisfaction, but research about changing jobs illuminates trends that can guide your decision-making, help lower the uncertainty, and manage your expectations. Research across many industries and countries has established that very distinct patterns occur in people's happiness when they change employment. The good news is that job satisfaction usually does indeed rise. Writing in a recent edition of the Journal of Organizational Behavior, scholars found that job changers rated their satisfaction with their old job at roughly 4.5 on a scale of 1 to 7. That changed to about 6 when they started their new job, and this rating held at 6 weeks in. That's how long the honeymoon lasted. At this point, satisfaction started to fall for about the next 5 months. At the six-month mark, on average, an inflection occurred, depending on the career orientation of the job changer. Those with a self-centered orientation, defined as those who see themselves as independently responsible for managing their careers and mostly think about their own benefit, stayed at this lower level, about 5.5, of satisfaction. This contrasted with those who had an organization-centered orientation, defined as prioritizing loyalty and security, and envisioning their career as part of a greater whole, as they started to see their satisfaction rise again after that six-month inflection point. The researchers did not track what happened after that, but it is reasonable to assume that the self-oriented folks continued to feel less satisfaction and the organization-oriented to feel more. After all, we know that the first group reported an intention to leave the new job at significantly higher rates than the second. Self-oriented careers have more churn and less job satisfaction than organization-oriented careers. A second pattern in the research from around the world is that those who are happier people in general are more adaptable in their careers. In fact, happiness, more than the perceived social support or a positive attitude about the future, is the most significant predictor of being able to cope with and make the best of professional changes of such as greater responsibilities and skill demands. In other words, people who are happier overall are more dissatisfied when they change jobs than unhappier people. Researchers also note that thriving in a career can be closely related to maintaining a healthy work-life balance, which is, of course, key to personal fulfillment. A third pattern in the data concerns the push versus jump factors in employment. Scholars writing in 2017 in the International Journal of Aging and Human Development found that people were happier with their career changes if they had made a shift of their own volition, as opposed to being laid off and having to find a new job. This isn't too surprising, but it underlines that people may have a choice about being proactive in the labor market when the job situation is uncertain. If you are considering a change of job or career but feel paralyzed by fear of the unknown, the research offers a few practical lessons to help assuage your anxiety, yet keep you from unrealistic wishes and rash decisions. 1. Manage your expectations. We've already seen that a job change usually increases satisfaction, but that much of this can wear off fairly quickly, within months, especially if you're not an especially organization-centered person. So coach yourself to be realistic. The change most likely won't make you worse off, but don't romanticize it. If your expectations are too high, you will be disappointed. Then you might find yourself on the job market over and over again, stuck in a cycle of unmet hopes. 2. Look for happiness outside of work first. Remember that the biggest predictor of work happiness is non-work happiness. I have witnessed this throughout my career, in myself and in others. When things are good in the rest of your life, they seem to be more stable and less bothersome at the job. Conversely, when we look for our overall well-being in what we are doing to earn a living, it places too much emphasis and pressure on the job, making it into a kind of religion. 3. Jump before you are pushed. Humans crave control over their environment. One of the most common correlates of depression is feeling that your life is out of your control, that external forces are determining what happens to you. Getting fired or laid off from work commonly provokes frustration, guilt, embarrassment, and anger, and is likely to coincide with less satisfaction when you find a new job. Sometimes losing your job comes as a complete surprise, but advance warning can take such forms as a change of management, a hiring freeze, or a switch in a product line. If you stay alert, you have a better chance of leaving on your own terms. People generally talk about moving jobs as a dramatic occurrence, a major life upheaval akin to getting married or divorced, and it can be that significant for people who have spent many years with a specific employer or who prize stability and security. But for most people, such adjustments happen many times. In other words, keep it all in proportion. Most people change jobs multiple times in their career. So the best practical advice, if you are sitting year after year in a frustrating gap between aspiration and action, wanting to change but fearing uncertainty, is simply this. It's really not that big a deal to try something else, so you might as well do it. Just bear in mind that the happier you are outside of work, the happier you are likely to feel in work. Next, An Ode to Not Meditating by James Parker. I know, it's good for you. It's good for us, damn it. Good for the nation. You're not going to open your blissfully defocused eyes after 20 minutes of meditation, sigh, rise slowly to your feet, then go charging off to sack the Capitol. Not immediately, anyway. And I also know that serious meditation practice is serious. It's not about gongs and white blankets. It's not about smooth vibes. It's not even about spiritual hygiene. What you get instead when you start to meditate, when you first sit with yourself, is a rather stunning immersion in the rawness and chaos of your own nature, the whirling thoughts, the howling needs, etc., etc. Light that stick of incense by all means, but it's the hell smoke of your own personality that you'll be smelling. I know all this because I sat with myself, and sometimes with other people also sitting with themselves, for a number of years. It helped me enormously. It calmed me down, but now I've stopped. And I have to tell you, I think I prefer myself as a non-meditator. The feeling is not unrelated to the pandemic, probably because nothing is unrelated to that bloody pandemic. As the world went flat as a pancake, I became less interested in leveling myself out. No steady drone of mental health for me. No thank you, not today. Let's have the spikes. Let's have the troughs. But there's more to it than that. The practice of not meditating, as I have pursued it over these past several months, not meditating first thing in the morning, not meditating during the day, and taking particular care not to meditate in the evening, has brought me home. Sensations, nice and nasty, possess me. Moods run me. I'm not observing my thoughts as they arise one by one unbidden from the ever-bubbling bed of the brain. I'm thinking my thoughts. I'm not groping toward the white light of nothingness that irradiates all phenomena. I'm stewing in the somethingness. Am I a tad less tranquil? Probably. But it's worth it. So, uncross those aching legs, solemn sitter. Open up. To the grand sensory flux, to the enthralling windshield feeling present tense, to the zillion emotional psychological tangles and the distractions and inundations on the and to the plain fact of your incorrigible temporary you-ness. Give it a shot. You can always ride them again, those glossy theta waves of deep meditation. They keep rolling. They roll forever. You, on the other hand, do not. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any other comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a great day.